Session number 9722.
Mr. Levine, Reel 6, you were talking about reserters.
I have seen
the material that's been researched on most of the people that served in Spain. And whilst it's not totally accurate in the sense that this bloke somehow or other has added things on which are necessary, like so-and-so as was in trouble with the police after coming back to England, been a petty burglar or a criminal and got 6 months or 3 months, which is unnecessary. But there's a great deal on people on the name of the vessel in which they travel from Barcelona or Valencia to England, or even from Gibraltar, some got to missing. And Alexander says there was 300 people who returned without permission. Don't forget there's over 2,000 people there. And in some cases, maybe they had justification in leaving, in the sense that they were wounded, you know, and they got to the coast, or there were a number of convalescent centres in southern Spain around places like, which are now, you know, concrete jungles, or Benidorm, Benicassim, and all those places, but they had convalescent homes. And it's very likely they were carried away by meeting sailors in the pubs there, in Valencia and so, and Alicante, or even Barcelona. And they said, come on, Jack, you know, come back with us. So maybe I shouldn't be too harsh, you see, with these people, you see, that they went home without permission, as Alexander prefers to call it. And perhaps it's best to leave it at that.
Now, you've criticised Homage to Catalonia as one particular book. Mm. Is there anything else that has appeared in the books on the Spanish Civil War that you feel is incorrect? That
well, a great many of our people have criticised Hugh Thomas's book, which is the Bible, I think, of the Spanish Civil War, mainly because in one passage he refers to the IB as a bunch of, you know, the British volunteers at least. There's a lot of ne'er-do-wells, or he had personal problems and sort of not very good types in general. Well, there might have been a few like that, but the vast majority I knew. For example, the six of us who left Manchester were all working. I worked for the CWS clothing factory in Manchester as a cutter. I left my job, and that's supposed to be a very good job in the 30s, because they didn't sack you when things got quiet. They kept you around. They were very enlightened employers, even at a canteen, which was unheard of in clothing factories in those days, or in most factories anyway. And we were all working, gave up the jobs to go to Spain. And most of the people I met were all very good types. There were, of course, a few scoundrels. I mean, some deserted from the early days at Jarama, returned to England, told stories to the Daily Mail, who featured them all the time, and said that they'd be hoodwinked. They told they were going to Spain to pick oranges and relieve agricultural workers to go into the army and all that sort of codswallop. But on the whole, there were some very, very fine people there, I can tell you that.
Now, you mentioned your rank, that you became an officer. What actual rank did you hold when you left?
That was equivalent. I've given my insignia to our archive we got here in Manchester at the Frau's Working Class Library, which was like a star and two red bars underneath it. That was the commissar. Now, for the military lieutenant, that was the rank of a lieutenant. That was in gold bars, you see, for the military man. And when I was in Albacete working in the administration of the International Brigades, I sometimes went to the officers' mess, and quite often I would see the so-called ogre, Andre Marty, come in with his wife for a meal. And he's always been presented, you know, one picks it up and that's established like that. That this man was a, you know, madman and so on. So he'd been a deputy of the French Parliament when he went to Spain. And as you know, his background, he was one of the leaders of the Black Sea Mutiny when there were taken part during the Russian Civil War, in which the French fleet revolted against supporting the white element in the Russian Civil War. I didn't get the impression of him. Can you imagine? There was over 10,000 Frenchmen in the international brigades. There must have been all sorts of people amongst that crowd that crossed over the frontier, which wasn't very difficult to do.
But did you speak to André Martin?
No. No, I had much French. I saw him often.
But you judged his demeanour?
That's right.
What was his demeanour?
Well, first of all, he was a man with a political background. He was already a member of the French Parliament, deputy for Paris somewhere. And he obviously knew that there was all sorts of people coming into the National Brigades to cause trouble, disaffection, and so on. Don't forget, the International Brigades were all volunteers. And I'm speaking now for the Anglo-Saxons, that everyone felt they had a right to criticise and put their point of view, and if necessary, tell the commander to go and get lost, and so on and so forth. Some did to Copeman, see? And it was very difficult to get all these men, who, most of them who were strong-minded politically, to be brought into a homogeneous sort of mass of disciplined people. It wasn't so easy. Not like the British Army, for example. If you stepped out of line, they stepped on you severely. I had a lot of trouble in the British Army, because to me it was a lot of nonsense. The bullshit. I tried to join the paratroops when I first got into the army, but I was too old, they wouldn't have me. And I wanted to be in a crack unit where there was self-discipline, as I'd been in the Spanish Civil War. But I wasn't able to do that because the War Office had already had tabs on me, and they had reported to where I was in training. I was not to be posted until further orders. And I was at a training camp for months and months at Alfreton in Derbyshire, a notorious place, by the way. And there was an A1 man wanted to take part and do a job of work. Must have been Barmy. I wanted to join the special service unit, but I couldn't speak French in the end. But then of course I was too old to go into the paratroops.
But you've been through the initial training in the British Army.
Yes.
Do you think that discipline in the International Brigade would have been easier if there'd have been a system of that of initial training on those lines?
Well, there was no possibility for initial training, especially in my experience. Later on, I have heard of people who came out later, who were only on the Aragon in 1938, where they spent months training under Russian officers, 3 months, 4 months. Well, there's nothing like that in the early days. I mean, I know people who arrived from Manchester 4 or 5 days after coming into Spain, were already on the front and getting wounded. I know one, Tommy Fannin, who lost a leg. He was only there 5 days. Mind you, he'd been in the British Army, Tommy Fannin. Incidentally, he had been in the army in Burma with George Orwell, whom he knew under the name of... Eric Blair. That's right.
What was this chap's name?
Oh, he's dead. Tommy Fannin.
How do you spell it?
Fanning. He'd been in the same unit. And... So there's no question of instilling discipline. I know it's absolutely necessary and all that. I mean, you've got to put the fear of God into people. But, you see, I didn't accept it because, I mean, I knew they couldn't shoot me or anything like that. And if I didn't want to do anything, I just couldn't do it.
No.
You know, I mean, there's regards fatigue and all that business, you see.
Just going back to your parents.
Yes.
Were your parents immigrants into Britain?
Yes. They were born in Lithuania. And my parents arrived in Manchester in 1895, along with many other Eastern Europe. You know, they simply flocked. Most of them went to the USA, but quite a number came into England.
Now, another thing you mentioned earlier was Harry Pollitt. Did you get to know him very well?
Yes.
Can you describe what kind of a chap he was?
Well, I put it succinctly, if you like. He was a man of the people. You know, he had no big ideas about himself. I've met leaders of the Communist Party who've often been to the Soviet Union and high up in the British Communist Party, you know, and they tend to get a bit removed, you know, as you can imagine this sort of thing happens. Egotism moves into it and so on. But you never had that feeling with Pollard, you see. He was of working class origin and retained his roots in that fashion, and he was one of the most brilliant orators in British public life, I can tell you that. One of the best. I mean, if that fellow hadn't been in the Communist Party and been in the Labour Party, he would have risen very high in the parliamentary Labour, no question about it. And everybody liked Pollard, liked him very much.
Why?
Well, first of all, when he used to come out I'll tell you something now which has not been revealed, which I've told Alexander, he doesn't believe me. He thinks I'm shooting a lion. I don't shoot lions. When he used to come out to Spain, Pollard made several visits to Spain. And he'd speak to the people that come out from the line and go and listen to a report from him. And he was with you. You felt it. Now, I had an experience with William Rust. I'd heard of William Rust. And this was when I was at Tarazona. And Tarazona then was full of American and Canadian veterans who had been, the Americans, they had been at Jarama and Brunetti. They'd lost a lot of people being wounded, and now they'd come down there for rest, I don't know, or what have you, and the Canadians. And morale was not very high amongst these people. I mean, all right, they'd done a fair amount, and they weren't looking forward to going back to the front again. You know, you're not dashing after you've been had two very heavy actions, you see. And I went to a meeting, and there was only a few English in Tarazona at that time, and I was in charge of the messing. And Rust came along. He wore a long black leather coat, see? And this was a meeting to raise morale amongst these veterans. He didn't say more than half a dozen sentences about the necessity of being prepared to go back to the, you know, propaganda speech. And these Americans, they didn't care who he was or what he was in the British Communist Party. They said, get back to the bloody front yourself, you big fat slob. And they shouted him down, and he couldn't make his speech. See? Now, that's something that actually happened. I told this to, because what's-his-name's listened to me, Alexander, when he was preparing for his book. This was at, what do you call it, at Loughborough. He came there, you see, and he spoke to some of the people there. Well, he's not going to put that in his book, you follow? And he wouldn't believe it. Or if he did believe it, it's not for publication, you see. But this happened. Some of those men went back to the front later on, but they weren't going to hear, listen to someone who'd never been at the front telling you to go back. And this is just a propaganda speech. And he was a bloody Englishman on top of it. And he speaking to 99% Canadians and Americans.
How did that compare with Harry Pollard?
Harry Pollard had a totally different approach. He would tell them, we're doing all we can for you in England. It's difficult to get parcels. He used to bring letters and parcels. I sent a letter to my brother asking me to get army grey socks, you see, because we didn't, you know, we were bloody walking about with, apart from poor footwear, you couldn't get socks. Right. So I asked him to send me some socks and put some woodbines, although I didn't smoke, woodbines in the wallet, and send it to King Street, you see, it would come through Pollard. And of course, I was very thankful for getting the socks, and I dished the woodbines out, you know, to the people. And each time he came, he would bring things. He would tell them what the Labour movement was doing, how they were trying to push the Labour movement to fight against non-intervention. But the Labour movement accepted non-intervention. The leaders of the Labour movement and the trade union at that time were very right-wing. People like Walter Citrine, Arthur Deakin, and the leaders of the Labour Party, who did not move against non-intervention until well on in the Spanish Civil War, but it was too late. But if non-intervention had been carried out from the very beginning, the Spanish Republic would have won, because it was only the immense amount of arms that came from Hitler Germany and Fascist Italy that turned the scale in favour of Franco.
But how would Pollitt adopt a different approach to Bill Rust if he wanted to encourage people to go on fighting?
Well, he would give you... He didn't speak to you about going back to the front or fighting, you know, out to the last man and that sort of thing. He gave you the impression that people back home were with you. There was a tremendous movement, as there was in Britain, amongst wide strata of the population. Even there was a Conservative MP, a Duchess of Atlas, somebody like that, who came out strongly in favour of the International Brigade in the Spanish Civil War and lost a seat in Parliament, I think, because of her stand. And there were all kinds of people. It was fantastic. We didn't know of it very much because I was there for quite a long time. But there was. And he gave you that impression that you're not on your own. See? There was a tremendous movement behind you. And that ultimately, you know, we'd win through and so on and so forth. And you never felt at odds with what you call it. But when you've got a man like Rust, who was a highly intellectual man, by the way, quite brilliant in many respects, but he never had that empathy with people who'd been through the mill, you know, at the front and so on. That's the impression I got.